1962, Ray Charles released Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, and it was a game changer in both pop and country music. It was a year of change, all chronicled in a terrific new book entitled 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK. We are pleased to be joined on Sports Lit 101 by the author of the book, David Krell. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We love this book so much, David. It was such a crucial year in American history, not just in sports, but in seemingly every aspect of American life. What drew you to write about and research this time in America?
Well, Rich and Bruce, as you know, being book aficionados, if you go to the bookstore, a library, or online, and you're looking for a book about a topic, and you cannot find it, that's the book you should write.
Very good.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
As a writer myself, I agree with that 100%. One of the things we did, David, when we talked about this book, it was something we don't normally do, and we did it over 2 weeks. Usually we talk about a book 1 week, and a few weeks later we'd like to have the author on, because I felt that I couldn't talk about both all the things that happened in baseball and all the wonderful things that happened in politics in the same year. What was your biggest challenge making this book, and it's incredibly readable, read so seamlessly when you're covering so many topics?
Gosh, the biggest challenge was whittling it down. I found so much information that I thought was pertinent, and then I kept asking my editor at University of Nebraska Press for an extension, and this went on for a few months. And finally, when I handed the manuscript in, it was around 365 double-spaced pages. And the reason it was so long is because I kept finding new information. Someone would mention a movie. I would find something in the course of research. And I said, oh, my God, I got to get that in. I have to get that in. The feedback was, great job, David. You have to cut it by 20%. So then I had to go back and decide what was extraneous and what wasn't, what interviews could be chopped, what could be truncated, what didn't I really need? Even though I wanted it, you guys know the first rule of writing is be prepared to throw your darlings overboard.
Yes.
Those beautiful paragraphs, those beautiful transitions that you spend days or weeks cultivating, for the sake of the story, for the sake of the narrative, you're going to have to get rid of them.
Well, baseball is certainly central to the book, but I love the way that you set it up by taking us into the world of popular culture, music, television, films of that time period, because that really takes us there. And I was just a little toddler at the time, but man, oh man, it took me back. But it also reminds us of how much was going on in America, and we talk about the change. There were some landmark television programs and films, along with great music as well.
Right. Well, I was born in 67, so my knowledge of 1960s pop culture came from reruns. So when you're coming home from school and you're playing board games with your friends, or you're sick and you have to stay home from school, what are you watching? It's F Troop, it's The Witch, I Dream of Jeannie, and in the New York area, we watched these on channels 5, 9, and 11. So I got a chance to go back and not only research the sitcoms that I knew fairly well, at least I knew enough to, I knew who Rob Petrie was on the Dick Van Dyke Show. I knew that Darren Stevens later on worked for McMahon and Tate, so that was not 62, but I knew enough. I did not know anything about dramas because I hadn't been exposed to them. I was never exposed to Route 66. I was never exposed to Sam Benedict or Perry Mason simply because they were never rerun on New York markets, or if they were, they were probably late at night or on Saturday afternoons when I was playing Little League. So I got a chance to research not only the well-known shows like Route 66, but a lesser-known show like Saints and Sinners or Sam Benedict. So it was a really good experience for me to see that 1962 was not as innocent as people think. And that's the most common comment that I got when people knew I was writing this was, oh, last year of innocence, year before the Kennedy assassination. Well, Cuban Missile Crisis, that was pretty serious. If you look at what's going on and you've read the book, you see in chapter one, I talk about the Route 66 episode in January. That revolves around a white supremacist and the two characters trying to take him down, working undercover for the FBI. This is real serious stuff for early 1960s.
Well, I was born in 1951, so what this book did, Rich and I were talking about this off air, I remember I was a Yankees fan, you know, I grew up in Connecticut, and so I was, you know, the baseball stuff, Jim Davenport and the Giants and all those guys, that all resonated with me. That was remembering. What I was astonished by was how I didn't remember the TV shows as being those years, right? And just sort of thinking they were on for a period of time, not realizing that when you encapsulate 62 and you think about, you know, Mary Early being the first black graduate of the University of Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
And you start thinking about all these things. It's astonishing to me. I knew they were important at the time. I didn't live in a bubble, but I was also only 11 years old. But I think back now and I was adding them up, it's sort of like looking at that 62 Mets team and seeing all those incredible baseball player names and knowing they were all at the end of their careers and not one of them could play much anymore, that I'd forgotten those kinds of things too. So I just think that the way that you fit all this together, Camelot and what I would call the nearing the end of the heyday of baseball was really great.
Bruce, thank you so much. Dr. Early, I just want to say and emphasize her angelic quality, her heroism, her courage in battling this in the civil rights era, and just wanting an education in music, which is a universal language, was just harrowing when I went through her papers and read the reports and read the newspaper articles. It's like living on a different planet. And someone had suggested to me along the way to write about James Meredith, who was the first black student to enter the University of Mississippi. I know enough to know that I can't tell you anything you don't already know about that story. It's been told by Mr. Meredith. It's been told by news reporters. It's been told by authors, journalists, civil rights activists. What can I possibly add to that story? So then I found Dr. Early.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, this is interesting. There were two black students who matriculated before her, but she was the first black graduate. And when I found that it was August, and that was the same year that Marilyn Monroe died, well, it started to become apparent to me I needed to have a chapter just about women.
We're talking with David Krell about his book, 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK. When it comes to the baseball, all of it was great, but I really loved your great research into how those two expansion teams were built, the New York Mets and the Houston Colt 45s, later Astros. What a fascinating story that was.
Thank you so much. I have to give credit to Vince Lee and his team at the University of Houston. He was in charge of the archives where the George Kirksey papers were held, and Kirksey was a public relations guy who helped the Houston Colt 45s get off the ground. And in his collection is a treasure trove for a baseball researcher. You find things you're probably not going to find in other collections regarding other teams. I had the demographic breakdowns. I had the media projections. I had the breakdowns of ownership. I had the team newsletters. It was just a total treasure chest of information for me. And I really needed it to chronicle the genesis of the Houston Ball Club when they wanted the major league team. The Buffaloes, great minor league team, would go by the wayside. And you need to prove all these things. Do you have the demographics? Do you have the fan base? Will people come to the ballpark? Will they listen on radio? Will they listen on television? What's the reach of the radio station? How many watts? What's the radius, et cetera? And, you know, Vince was just fantastic at the University of Houston.
Well, the other interesting thing I really liked about the Houston story is not only did they find a way to get a baseball team, but they have to create an environment for them to play in because it rains every afternoon in Houston or it's beastly hot. And that I don't think anybody, when you look at stadiums today, whatever the Astrodome was or wasn't when it was built, the stadiums today owe a tremendous debt to that because it was right. It was a vision outside of the norm.
Oh, absolutely. This was the space age for sure. And the Astrodome had the groundbreaking in January of 62, where the VIPs shot guns into the ground. I mean, they literally shot, you know, pulled the trigger. Can you imagine doing that today? So the Astrodome debuts in 65. These guys play in Colt Stadium. It's muggy. There are mosquitoes. And, you know, when the Astrodome comes a couple of years later, it's just a marvel. They did call it the eighth wonder of the world. And you're right. After the Astrodome, we got the Metrodome in Minnesota, the Silver Dome in Michigan. New Orleans has a dome. So it was a trendsetter. I gave a speech or a lecture at the Sabre Conference in Houston talking about the Astrodome's efficiency and how it was the place in the 70s and 80s for star-studded spectaculars like the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs tennis match.
And of course, there would have been no baseball team in Houston were it not for the space program. And as a kid who grew up knowing every astronaut on every crew in those early Gemini and Apollo missions, it was great. That whole subplot was fascinating as well.
Oh, absolutely. And space was so prominent in the culture. You couldn't turn on the television without seeing a newscast or maybe a primetime show. There's a Perry Mason episode that I talk about where they reference Shepard, Grissom, and Glenn. And this is only a couple of months after Glenn's orbit around the Earth, where he's the first American astronaut to orbit the Earth. And this episode, by using their names, makes it seamless. There is a sense of what my 10th grade English teacher would call verisimilitude, where things are incorporated into a fictional story to make it real and give you a real sense of time and place. So now, obviously, kids don't really know about the space program, but every kid in America was probably tuned to this show that their parents were watching just because it had a space theme in that particular story.
Well, yeah, and verisimilitude, boy, that's what this book has. That was something my 10th grade English teacher at Vermont Academy used to tell me all the time, too. That any writer needs to do that. When you and we've got a little bit of time left, but I wanted to ask you this one question. If you could pick out that moment, it was the aha moment for you in writing the book. What was the one thing you came across and you went, wow? Was there one more than any other? I mean, it may be an unfair question, but
no, I appreciate the question. When I found the Kennedy photo, when I was sitting in the JFK library in Boston and the archivist was pointing me towards the website and how to select photos, and I went through all the sports photos, and when I found this gorgeous color photograph of Kennedy throwing out the first ball at the All-Star Game in Washington in 62, my heart just leapt. You know, I skipped a few beats. I said, oh my God, this is the cover. This is the cover. Please, God, let them take this for the cover. And to my excitement, they did.
Well,
it was just one of those points where you talk about aha, where the light bulb goes on. And this is what I came here for. This is exactly what I came here for, because I might not use all of the research that I found. I used a great deal of it, but words can be, you know, truncated, as we said. Photos tell 1,000 words. You know, photograph, what's that saying? A photograph tells 1,000 words or speaks 1,000 words. This was it. And that just captured the essence of, you know, there was a certain, I wouldn't say innocence, but there was a certain sense of optimism, which is the theme of the book, and a president from the stands throwing out the first pitch. It seems quaint now. It seems somewhat quaint when we look at that photo that a president can walk down with the Secret Service, with the vice president, with his advisors, do the ceremonial throwing, go back to the White House, get back to work within a half hour. that's just a different world that I'm not a participant of. The best I can do is create the sense that this was what was going on in the time. This was the attitude of the people. These were the experiences. And it's a slice of life. It's not meant to be a microscopic look at the 62 World Series between the Yankees and the Giants, or a microscopic look about the Dodger Stadium debut, or Maury Wills' great season of 104 stolen bases, or Don Drysdale winning 25 games. It's not a microscopic look at Hollywood, which had a groundbreaking year that year. It's a sense of time and attitude and feeling that I wanted to capture. And you said, what was the biggest challenge? Part of it is whittling everything down so you get a sense of that.
Dave, we've got to wrap it up, but thank you so much. Okay. It was a remarkable book, 1962, Baseball in America in the Time of JFK. We couldn't put it down. And thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you, guys. Best to you. Stay healthy. Bye-bye.
All right. You too. David Krell with us on Downtown.